This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. How do birds migrate? No, really, how do they do it? I mean, what's the mechanism? And did you know that reptiles can actually decide the sex of their offspring? How do they do that? They can actually sense the male-to-female ratio in their area and then choose the gender of their babies. Stacy Bilbo is fascinated with questions like that and also how the brain affects animal behavior. She's an associate professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke University, and she studies the interaction between the brain and the immune system. Her work has some pretty heavy implications for humans, but she came to her work by way of her interest in animals, and we are going to find out all about that today when we meet Stacy Bilbo. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much. I'm really happy to be here.
So first, I got to ask you about the reptiles and their ability to sense the gender balance in their environment, right? And then nurture the right. Tell us about that.
Right. So as an undergrad at the University of Texas, I started kind of my path in research by starting to work in this lab with frogs and lizards and turtles, I initially wanted to work in the lab because I thought, you know, who wouldn't want to play with frogs and lizards all day? But they were doing amazing research looking at how temperature would impact whether the offspring would end up male or female. And so in gecko lizards, these are like northern gecko lizards, they're the really cute ones with all the spots. If the eggs are kind of intermediate temperature, then they end up male. And if the eggs are kind of very hot or very cold, then they end up female. And so the amazing thing is that the moms basically lay on the eggs to determine this temperature. And if you have a colony of geckos, you end up with pretty much a 50-50 male-female ratio. So it's kind of amazing how that happens. So they must have been able to sense somehow from the environment the ratio of females and males in that particular colony room. We weren't actually studying that directly. What we were then studying was how temperature then gets transduced into a hormonal signal, which is then going to change the way the brain develops and either be male or female. But that really got me kind of, onto the path of wanting to understand how animals and humans do so many amazing things in terms of their physiology.
Yeah, that is cool. And then which ones actually go on to become mascots for insurance companies? How do you know? How does the mother know? And it is fascinating, as you say, first of all, that temperature can then affect the outcome of the offspring, right?
Right.
I mean, so how does that, what is that mechanism? And they're picking up a signal, and so they know kind of how long to sit on one egg or another. I assume that that's how they change the temperature, right?
Right, exactly.
And I guess just as maybe a trivial outcome, that the most boring of all, the mediocre temperature, they're the men.
Well, yeah. So we always thought that was pretty interesting. That really the boys are kind of the weaklings.
Yeah, there you go.
And the females are very resilient at either end. Now, not all reptiles are like that. Some others have one temperature, one extreme is males, and the other extreme are females. But yeah, that was definitely a running joke in the lab
for that lizard. So, but that gets into some of what you're really interested in, which is not the thing we notice. I mean, I'm interested. It's a fascinating thing to think about how birds migrate or how animals figure out the gender ratios. But you really want to know the mechanism. What's
right.
going on biologically? What's it receiving? And then where does it get processed in this animal
right.
to change the behavior of the animal?
Exactly.
And this takes us to, you also did some research with Siberian hamsters, which gets us a little closer on the chain to us humans. Tell us about that research.
Right. So I did my graduate work at Johns Hopkins with Randy Nelson, and he is a biological rhythms a researcher, essentially. And so rhythms such as the sleep-wake cycle. But for animals, we were thinking of it actually on a much longer time span, which is the seasonal cycle. So changing from summer to winter. And so we worked with these adorable creatures called Siberian hamsters. And they're actually from Siberia. So the stock that we had were this kind of wild stock that we brought to the lab. And what we were interested in was the fact that they don't actually hibernate through the winter. So they stay kind of alert and foraging all winter. But what they do during the winter is what a lot of animals do in order to survive is their physiology completely changes. And so they go from brown to solid white. They lose a lot of body mass, which makes them more metabolically efficient. And they stop reproducing, which is really critical. So they're incapable of reproducing during this time. But the thing that I was interested in and what I started working on right away was how the immune system responds to this. So if you totally change the metabolism of an animal, does the immune system change in any way as well? And if an animal is reproducing or not, does that impact the immune system? And it turns out it does profoundly. And so what we really discovered was that there's this really elegant trade-off in whether the animal was kind of essentially giving metabolic energy to reproduction during the summer, and you saw kind of a ramping down of several different immune responses. But in the winter, when the energy was now not being used for reproduction, which is a huge cost for any animal, especially females, you see this ramping up of the immune system. So it was really remarkable. In fact, the animals in this winter-like state were able to recover from fevers more quickly. They were able to recover from stress more quickly, things that really dramatically change the immune system. And so you saw this just really elegant adaptation.
And we might assume that winter is the time when a hive powered immune system is a bigger requirement, right?
Exactly. At least that's what we think. That basically, they had higher numbers of immune cells just circulating around in the bloodstream, and then if they got a cut on the skin or an infection, all of those immune cells would then stream into the area of the skin, and it was just much more efficient in the winter hamster than in the summer hamster. And we thought, well, you know, winter is hard for a lot of animals. We have heating and air conditioning, and it's very different for animals in the wild. And so you can just see these amazing adaptations play out.
And when we think about reproductive systems shutting down, turning on and off too, we also think about the seasonal effect. In other words, you want to have your babies at a time when it's optimal for them to survive. But I guess the gestation period for these animals is pretty quick. So they could...
Very quick, yeah. Yes. And that's exactly what happens, is that they begin, to breed in the spring, and then they have a gestational period of, in a hamster, it's only 18 days. So they can have babies and then have babies again and then maybe even again in the course of a summer where there's lots of food. But then when the days start getting shorter, that's their cue to stop reproducing.
And again, we've only a limited amount of energy in this system, so we're going to have to be very wise about when we're going to shift energy from one to the other. Winter's a tough time. Let's shift to the immune system, and we'll worry about the babies a little later.
Right.
And so any implications then for humans? What are the implications for humans in this?
Right. So, we get asked that question a lot, it's, as I mentioned a minute ago, because we have kind of all of our modern heating and cooling, and we've kind of have an override of the natural environment, we don't tend to see many seasonal changes in immune function, but there's certainly some, and you see it to a larger extent in some indigenous cultures. But what I think it has greater implications for is work that I'm not doing, but my advisor went on to continue doing and is doing now, is looking at the impact of basically the impact of light on the immune system. And some of the things that he's finding is that artificial light at night, as he calls it, has a tremendous impact on health. So it can impact cancer. It can impact whether you survive from heart attacks. all kinds of different aspects of physiology, which are driven through this kind of light photic cue to the immune system, and therefore...
Is this good impact or bad impact?
Bad. In the sense that we have a lot of artificial light at night that we did not evolve with, so we're not used to seeing this amount of light. Mm-hmm. And that kind of shifts the immune system in ways that I guess we aren't prepared to deal with. But I think it has the most implications for people who do shift work or jet lag, those types of things. And you do see a greater incidence of many different kinds of diseases in shift workers.
You wonder how much of that is the reaction to light at night when you didn't expect it, and how much of that is that the light allows us to work at times when our body would just as soon we'd be resting.
Yes, I think it's probably both of those. Yeah. And so some of the cool stuff he's doing now is he's actually going into hospitals and, you know, and showing them these data and saying maybe you shouldn't have the lights on all night when you're caring for critically ill patients, you know.
I know, but if you've been lying in that bed, that'd be good advice, right?
Yeah, right.
Turn the light off.
Yes. I'll
take the pill at 9 in the morning if you don't
yes.
mind. I want to find out more, Stacy, and how you became interested in all this as we continue our conversation with Stacy Bilbo, who is an assistant professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke University. Our conversation continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today I'm talking to Stacy Bilbo. She is an associate professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke University. And we were talking about some of the fascinating research you did as a graduate student and beyond. But I want to ask you how you got interested in these sort of fundamental mechanisms of behavior and brain science to begin with.
Right. That's a great question. I wish I could remember that
back. It was one day. Just start with the date, and it'll all come back to you.
Right. Well, I think you mentioned it maybe at the beginning, and that's that I've always been interested in animals, you know. So I was always the kid, like, you know, in the backyard, digging in the dirt, finding bugs and, you know, wanting to know what kind of bug it was, or, you know, picking up turtles in streams and taking them home. And I mean, and my whole family was like that. You know, my mom was the type of mom where she would go out and rescue squirrels that had been, like, abandoned and try to, like, take care of them and bring them back to life. And
how do you even identify an abandoned squirrel? How do you know? You know,
just
has a little
right,
satchel on its back. And
it's like a little blob when it's that age. So, yeah, so it could have been a rabbit. I don't know. But we did raise a squirrel at one point. And, you know, we always had dogs and cats, and I just have always felt like we can learn a lot from animals. They all have their own interesting and amazing ways of interacting with the world. And so, like I mentioned, when I had the chance, you know, I always thought I wanted to be a psychology major in college, and I was from the beginning. And maybe it's just I want to know how things work, how the mind works, but really, again, when I got the chance to work in this lab with lizards and frogs, I thought this is perfect because, you know, I just love interacting with them.
That's how I knew you loved animals, because you said, who wouldn't love to work with lizards and snakes and frogs? I'm thinking, well, about half of the population in the world, but apparently you think everybody loves animals. And also, and were very interested in dance as a young girl.
Absolutely. Yes. I was very into dance. I was part of, you know, just kind of the regular state, not state, school dance team during high school. But I started kind of dabbling in dance as young as 4 and doing different dance lessons and got really serious about it in high school. I don't know that I was ever very good at it, though, so that's why I didn't try to pursue it.
Well, did you think about it, though?
I did think about it, for sure. Yeah. And, you know, I think a fair number of little girls must dream about being, you know, the prima ballerina one day, but I really dreamed about it. I mean, that was absolutely something I wanted to do.
Though you may be the only one who imagined yourself in a tutu holding a frog, I don't know. And you moved around a lot, too, didn't
yes.
you?
Yes. Yes, we moved a lot. My dad was a professor of theater and languages So you would think that that would not dictate moving around much. But he has serious wanderlust. I mean, to this day, I have no idea where he's going to be at any given time. He's always in some foreign country, and he just loves to travel. And so I think that that for good or for bad kind of impacted when I was younger. We would move a lot from place to place. Not the best thing for children in school, but it is what it is.
No, but if you love animals, you see a great variety of wildlife.
Yes, definitely.
And then I understood also that you got interested in science, perhaps when you met up with some military recruiters. Was it in high school?
Yes. So in high school, at least in my high school, the Army would come every year, and they would give us this aptitude test for recruiting into the military, and a fair number. I went to a really small little school in Texas, unfortunately, not a lot of people even went to college from my high school. A lot of people went into the Army, usually because of finances. Mm-hmm. So they would come every year and try to recruit people, and they would make us take this test. And so I scored like higher than any female had ever scored on this aptitude test for the Army in my high school. And so they were just after me from that point on. And I think the reason I did well on it is because everybody else just kind of blew it off because they were like, I don't want to go in the Army. But I cannot take a test and not do my best on it. It's just impossible. So I sat there the whole, like, you know, hour and a half and, you know, just really tried my best. So I discovered I did have some kind of intrinsic aptitude for math and science from that, for sure.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, how did that change your thinking about math? I mean, I guess this gets, I'm sort of thinking about some of the cultural expectations we have about when we read so much research about how difficult it is to attract women to the sciences, and that perhaps something's going on in schools that's either subtly or overtly discouraging women from science. And so here you take this test and you say, oh, I must be good at this. It came as a revelation to
it
you?
It really did, actually. I mean, and I don't even remember the name of the teacher, so I won't be in danger of calling him out. But at one point in like 8th or 9th grade, I actually got put into a remedial math class because they told me I wasn't any good at math. And then the very next year, I got put into the advanced, like, algebra class because they were like, why are you in the remedial class? You should not even be in the regular. You should be in the... So they really couldn't make up their mind about me. And so, but that had a serious impact on me, having, you know, being told you're not good at something.
Yeah.
It, you know, so when I then, you know, took that exam and they said, you know, you did, and it was all like kind of engineering and trigonometry and all this kind of stuff. And I was really good at it. And I thought, maybe I can actually do this.
Well, if you hadn't taken that test, huh?
Yeah.
So you're doing that and then interested in psychology as well. And forensic psychology interested you at one point.
Yes. So I went so far as wanting to join the FBI so I could be a forensic psychologist with the FBI. And I was actually in contact with the FBI. And in Texas, the big school, the university for doing this kind of stuff, forensic science, was Sam Houston State, where the big penitentiary is, the kind of the maximum security prison there. And so they need people to come in and evaluate inmates on death row. And I thought that's what I wanted to do at one point. And then I saw the movie Silence of the Lambs, and I decided I didn't want to do that anymore.
I guess it would discourage at least touring the cell block. But so this does get into the kind of why, though. You're asking yourself, are you how is this a biologically determined in an individual?
Exactly, right? Which I think is really fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, why are there mass murderers? I mean, I think everybody wonders that. But really, is this a biological anomaly? Were they born with, you know, this brain, or what happened?
So the FBI is out. What did you do next? You didn't lose your interest in that kind of psychology and that kind of brain biology, obviously.
Right. Well, I kind of came back around to the idea of pathology in humans only really now as a professor in my own work. So for, again, you know, throughout undergrad and grad school, I studied animals and different adaptations. And then for my postdoc, I started studying the brain again, and not just the brain, but kind of where the psychology comes in. And that is interactions of the brain with other systems in the body, which then interact with the environment, how that then impacts the way we behave, and also the risk of different disorders like anxiety or depression or, you know, to some extent, even things like schizophrenia.
And to the extent that neurobiology was tackling these questions, a lot of the investigation happens sort of in the frontal part of the brain where we make decisions and in memory and all of those elements that we think are driving behavior. And then you discover something called neuroimmunology, which implicates the immune system, which we hadn't really been thinking about so much.
Exactly. So for a very long time, these two disciplines were very separate. You know, so that the neuroscientist really studied everything above the neck, to some extent the peripheral nerves as well. But really the neuroscientists that were tackling issues like depression or schizophrenia, they're thinking about, like you just said, the frontal lobe or whatever part of the brain might be important. And the immunologists, on the other hand, were really thinking about the spleen and the lymph nodes and T cells and B cells and these types of things, and that it was not thought that these two things interact at all. And just within the past couple decades, this field has really begun to explode because we're realizing that none of these systems work in a void. You know, they all work together, including the endocrine system as well. So the hormones that we produce. And so, you know, nerve cells can impact immune cells directly by secreting molecules that bind to immune cells and change their function. And immune cells can actually enter the brain and impact nerve cells directly. And all of these things can impact, in turn, behavior.
Yeah, that's the sort of the last surprise in all of this. First of all, when I was learning biology, the idea that there was even much of an immune system in the brain was sort of not forthcoming. That was the idea was the brain was such a remarkably closed system, there wasn't much of a need for an immune system up there because not a lot got in. Well, since then we've learned that there is a lot more protection up there. So if you can, describe how that works and how our understanding of the brain's own immune system has changed.
Right. So absolutely. It was thought, you know, for a long time that there's this immune privilege, that immune responses simply don't occur within the brain. You don't have correct lymphatic drainage from the brain, so there's no way that the immune system could ever see what it needs to see like it does in the rest of the body. We now know that there is a lymphatic drainage system for the brain where you can basically present molecules to the immune system so that they can respond. But the way that the field has really changed the most is the knowledge that there are immune cells that live in the brain called microglia. And I'm a huge fan of microglia.
Two-time Grammy Award winner.
And, yes. Yeah. They are my favorite subject for sure at this point in my career. I'm so fascinated by them because they have a very interesting life story. They have an interesting developmental history, if you will, because they actually enter the brain starting at about mid-gestation in humans and in other animals. And what they do is they don't come from the same part of the developing neural tube that all of the other neurons and other cells in the brain come from. They come from a part called the mesoderm, which is this other layer of the embryo, which actually gives rise to things like muscles and bone and immune cells and really all blood cells. And so they come into the brain during embryogenesis. And they initially kind of cluster around little ventricles in the brain or spaces in the brain. And then they start to kind of move from there and they take over the entire brain. And not take over the brain, but they populate the entire brain from there. And the question that I've had from the beginning after kind of noticing this is, you know, one, what's driving them there? You know, what's actually calling and recruiting them in there? And then the other thing is that if you look at different brain regions, you see that there's kind of a different pattern for different brain regions. So some brain regions kind of light up with these cells much earlier than other brain regions. And the question has been, why? What are they doing? And
Well, let me stop you there just for a second, because it's interesting that, and you told me just before the show that we'd known about these guys for a long time. The fact of them has been known for 100 years or more, right? And that
yes.
they appeared to people who could see them under microscopes as kind of odd little creatures to begin with.
Yes, yes. So the early neuroanatomists that did all of these beautiful drawings of all of the different cellular elements of the brain, like Camillo Golgi and Ramon y Cajal and Rio de Ortega, they kind of drew them, these beautiful drawings. I mean, they're beautiful cells. I mean, again, I'm biased, but they're the most fascinating cells. They have all these elaborate processes where they kind of reach out. But they called them... it was something like they look like visitors from another place. Like they knew then that right. these are not just the same as all of the other cells that are in the brain. The reason that they're fascinating beyond the fact that they're, you know, kind of interesting in terms of where they come from or what they look like or whatever, also though, is that they're now implicated in kind of a vast number of different neurological disorders. It's becoming apparent that just as inflammation in the periphery is starting to be, so like inflammation in the blood vessels is starting to be linked to heart disease and even things like diabetes, well, inflammation in the brain is starting to be linked to things like Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's disease, and even to things like depression. And we know that these cells play a big role in those things.
So tell us more about these microglia now that we do know. I mean, it's interesting that they've been laying around the brain and attracting attention for a long time, and yet nobody's quite figured out what they're doing until now. And part of it is immune. So when I think of immune, I think of, well, an immune response. Okay, if the brain's infected, these guys light up and they get rid of the disease. But it seems to me they're doing more than that.
Yes, absolutely. So they definitely respond to any kind of infection, any kind of perturbation of homeostasis, like a stroke or something. They're going to respond very vigorously to something like that. But during brain development, so for a long time, it was thought that they really kind of just sit up in the brain, and then if something bad happens, then they respond. But then with the advent of new kind of imaging techniques, which allows you to image the brain, the live brain, in real time, it was found that these cells aren't just sitting there. They're actually constantly moving around. So they're constantly moving their little arms, which they move in and out of the tissue, and it looks like they're looking for something. And what we think they're doing is they're actually sampling the environment. So they're sensing chemicals in the environment. And if you have a stroke, for instance, they do become more active in that area. But in development, they're also doing something really cool, and that is that during brain development, your brain grows at a really rapid pace, right? So, you know, kids have ginormous heads because their brains are so big relative to their bodies. So during the ages between like 1 and 3, the brain grows exponentially. And what happens is you actually have many more cells than you need at that time. You grow too many neurons and too many connections between neurons, but that's a normal process. So then over the following many years, all the way up until like, you know, at least 20 years old, you're actually kind of removing some of those extraneous cells and some of those extraneous connections.
And let me just stop you there. The what is extraneous, of course, is determined by your environment. So the stuff that you need stays for whatever it is you're doing in whatever part of the world you live in, and the stuff you don't need goes away. And that's all dependent on kind of where you are and what you're doing.
Exactly. And so it's something called experience-dependent plasticity. So if you raise an animal in total darkness, then all of the neurons that are important for vision will not develop properly, right? So in that, you can think that of any cell in the body, there's a lot of experience dependent kind of remodeling and restructuring going on. So microglia, it turns out, are these kind of, they're similar to cells in the periphery, which are known as the big eaters, in the sense that they actually eat stuff. So they phagocytose stuff is the proper term. So it turns out that microglia in the brain, in the developing brain, eat the cells that we don't need, as well as some of the connections between cells that we don't need. And so it's become quite interesting to think, you know, are they actually selecting the cells that we don't need, or are they just responding to something?
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you. I'm going to take a break right now and come back, because I want to know if they're making the decisions or if they're being told to go eat, and we don't need this part of that individual anymore. It's all fascinating. And then what that means for normal development and abnormal development in all of us, and the relationship between our immune system and neurodevelopment, all of it. We're talking with Stacy Bilbo today, Associate Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at Duke University. And our conversation continues in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking to Stacy Bilbo, Associate Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at Duke University. We've been talking about microglia, which apparently is Stacy's favorite cell in the body, and it does a lot of very important things. Immune cells that actually live in the brain and do a lot more work than we ever thought they did. So let's talk a little bit more about how they respond to any kind of change in the brain that it doesn't seem to like. We were talking about actually pruning. So now we're in a developing brain. We've got all these possibilities. We're going to start packing it in now. We don't need this. We don't need that. And there are parts of the brain cells that go eat this stuff.
Right.
Does the microglia decide, or is it told to go get that those cells?
Well, we don't really know the answer to that question, but I would say that it's probably that they are responding to a signal that a neuron is presenting. Where it gets more interesting, though, is when we start to talk about any kind of perturbation, so any kind of environmental event that might now call on these cells as their role as part of the immune system, and whether that might disrupt normal brain development because they're now not pruning correctly. So maybe they're suddenly making bad decisions, if you will, or maybe they're under pruning in some way. And there are a lot of disorders that we think might be linked to changes or dysfunctional pruning, like autism, for instance, and schizophrenia, where it's just thought that the wiring is not, set up correctly somehow. And could it be linked to a change in the way these cells are they're not kind of properly pruning anymore.
And that has to do with maybe an early infection, either in utero or shortly after. So tell us about that, how brain development now is subject to these immune responses in ways that we hadn't thought about before.
Right. So, so this is the work that actually got me started doing this in the first place, was this this interest in what happens if you activate the immune system early in life to the way that it functions throughout the remainder of the lifespan, and does it have any impact on brain development? And so if you have, especially, for instance, preterm infants are very vulnerable to infections, if you have an infant that recovers, does it have any long-term impact on the brain? And, of course, ultimately, is there anything we can do about it? Well, one of the things that we found in our rodent model is that if you give a newborn rat a bacterial infection and you look at the animal when it grows up. So this is a bacterial infection that obviously is not lethal. So the animal survives and they grow up and they look like normal rats. And then you put the rat into a cognitive task, one of our mazes that we use, and you ask, does it look any different from a control animal, one that didn't have an infection? And actually the answer is no, they look the same. They learn just fine. But where it got interesting was that we then gave the animal, around the time that it was supposed to be learning this new maze, we gave the animal an injection of dead bacteria, which doesn't do anything except that it activates the immune system profoundly. And the immune system recognizes it as if it's live bacteria, responds, and, you know, does its thing. It gets cleared very rapidly because it's dead. But all of a sudden, these animals started exhibiting profound memory impairments and some other behavioral abnormalities as well. And so it was very interesting because basically this second hit that we call it, had unmasked something that was different about the brains of these animals. And it wasn't that they still had an infection. So they don't have a chronic illness. They don't have a chronic disease. They don't have lesions in their brains. But their microglia are different. So the microglia stay essentially permanently changed as a consequence of this early infection. And they now over-respond to the second hit, to this dead bacteria, and they pump out too many inflammatory factors. So, of course, you want your microglia to respond to an infection. That's, you know, you need to clear the infection. That's a good thing. But they're kind of overzealous microglia now.
So and, is this a little bit analogous to an allergic response?
It is, absolutely. It's a great analogy because often in allergies, you're having kind of an inappropriate immune response to something that shouldn't be harmful. And over time, you can actually become more and more sensitized, right? And in fact, we do have evidence in those animals as well that in some ways they become kind of more and more sensitized if they see repeated infections, which is really troubling, right? And the most interesting thing is that there's clearly this sensitive window in which this can occur. So if they got the same bacterial infection when they were a little older, kind of as teenager rats, then they didn't have this same long-term impact. So there's something really critical about this early period of life when the brain is building and all of the sculpting is happening and the microglia are critical for sculpting, that, you know, things that happen then are especially hurtful or potentially beneficial as well.
Right. So the response is later, which could, I suppose, lead to some answers to questions that that have been a little sticky going into this, where, you know, implications for things like Alzheimer's, where we think we might know a cause, but it happens with some people and not with others. Well, if we went back and found that one may have had some kind of early infection and one didn't, is this part of the implication? This is one of the variables that we hadn't taken into account for later onset for diseases and disorders.
Absolutely. And I think it is so important when we talk about neurodegenerative diseases, where we talk about diseases which are typically associated with aging, to consider the life history of that individual and going all the way back to the beginning. And of course, this is difficult because people live a long time. But one of the things that we did find with these same rats is that when we basically allowed a group of rats that had an infection early in life to grow older into middle age. Before normal animals start to show cognitive decline, because really old animals, as with people, all kind of start to show some cognitive decline. So we kind of caught them before they would start to show normal decline. And what we found was that even without a second hit, even without reactivating their immune system, the animals that had an infection early on showed greater cognitive decline later. And so it really, you know, told us a lot about revealing why it is that some individuals age more successfully than others when you're going to talk about things like cognition, at least.
Right. And the implications for treatment, of course, become complicated because the infection itself might have been, in a sense, trivial. It might have gone almost unnoticed in terms of any expression in that individual. So you might not even have known they had it.
Right. Yeah.
That makes things even worse for you. Even harder. Because we're talking about treatment, but before we get into the implications for treatment, I want to talk about some of the research you've done on socioeconomic status, because
yes,
that also has an impact on this.
Absolutely. So, you know, stemming from this interest in early infection, I really started to think about, you know, the fact that the immune system is really our interface with our environment in many ways. And the immune system is now critically communicating with the brain and vice versa. And so it really kind of broadened my thinking about what other types of developmental events might be important for changing the way the brain develops and changing the risk of neuropsychiatric disorders later. And I got involved with a project with a couple other researchers at Duke that was, and as well as with the Environmental Protection Agency, which was looking at the impact of air pollution on developing organisms. And they do this in human cohorts in Durham, actually. But they wanted to develop an animal model to try to look more mechanistically at what might be happening. And so basically it's a pollutant model where pregnant mothers get exposed to this diesel exhaust particle. And then the question is what happens to the offspring? And probably not surprisingly, there's an impact on lung outcomes like asthma. So these animals actually, as adolescents, start to show symptoms of asthma. But we wondered also what's happening to the brain. And interestingly, we didn't actually see much. We didn't see much of an impact on brain function. So that's good, right? But then we also thought, well, there's really another aspect of socioeconomic status, or many aspects, and that is that households that live in kind of lower income areas don't just deal with greater exposure to a number of different toxins, but they also have fewer resources. And that's stressful, like in a really psychological sense, it's stressful. And can stress actually change the susceptibility of a developing organism to a particular toxin? So is it worse if you have stress than if you don't? And the answer was yes. So if we then gave these mothers that were being exposed to air pollution also a pretty mild stressor, then the impact on the offspring was much worse.
Actually, tell us about that stressor. I find it kind of interesting.
Yeah, so it's basically a resource deprivation model. And, you know, when you're working with an animal model, you have to think, okay, so what's important for a mouse, you know, because they don't live in houses. But they do make these really comfy nests for their pups using cotton material. And so we always give them plenty of this material, and they build a huge nest. It's literally nesting mode that they go into. And you can't even see them anymore because they're totally like encapsulated in this nest, and all the pups are tucked in there. If we just took away a third of the nesting material during the prenatal period, before they even had their pups, there was a tremendous effect on the later outcome. So it was clearly a psychological stressor for them. Oh, I don't have enough. I don't have enough resource. And then later, when we looked at the pups, they had cognitive deficits. They had anxiety. They had a lot of different markers of kind of increased inflammation, which we think would probably be bad down the line in terms of a number of different disease susceptibilities. So it was just remarkable that, you know, if you just looked at the effect of the stress alone or just the the air pollution alone, you didn't really see much. But when you combine them, they completely synergize.
Well, and this is the difficulty in trying to even promote regulation, in that if you test for one factor and you don't see socioeconomic status or even social structure as a kind of biological element. It's not just something that we live in. It's part of our bodies. It goes clearly, if it's affecting brain development, it seems to me it makes the research more complicated. But it also means that we can't conclude just by testing diesel fuel that it's okay to put more of this in our air if we don't do some of these other tests along with it.
Absolutely. And I think that's the take-home message of this work. And it's actually a topic that the EPA is more and more interested in, and they call it environmental justice. And it's basically the idea that there are vulnerable populations. So some populations are more vulnerable to different elements in the environment than others. And so you have to consider that when you think about regulations. And an affluent neighborhood will not be as adversely affected by different toxins.
Does it suggest to you, I mean, I just made a statement which is probably not scientifically sound, but the idea that social structure, that the social structures that we build are actually part of our biology. I mean, is that a sound way of researching who we are? It's not just the thing we live in, but in fact an essential part of our biology.
Absolutely. And I think that is at the core of what neuroimmunology is, or I'll introduce another term here, which is actually psychoneuroimmunology, which is what I would also define myself as, which is basically the interface between neuroscience, immunology, and psychology. And it's the idea, the things that were, you know, until recently thought to be a little bit airy-fairy, if mm-hmm. you will, in the sense that, oh, that's soft science, you know, things like social support and the way that has such a profound impact on whether you survive cancer or not, or things like stress and how stress has a real biological impact on your body, and we are starting to understand why in terms of what it does to the immune system, what the immune system can then do to the brain, vice versa. It introduces all kinds of new avenues for research into things that the kind of the standard medical community has been rather slow to embrace, but are starting to. I mean, the number of hospitals that now employ things like meditation as a coping strategy for improving health is just, you know, increased exponentially in the last 5 years, I would say.
Well, has this research changed the way you live?
Absolutely. So I feel very strongly that your brain's health is impacted by your body's health and vice versa. So you can't just kind of walk around in the world and act as if your environment and the way you kind of move in the environment isn't changing your entire physiology. So my hobby is actually yoga. I love yoga. I'm a yoga teacher in my part time, in my free time, what little there is. But it's just kind of a basic understanding that the way we eat, the way we exercise, the way we take care of ourselves, the kind of mindfulness strategies have a tremendous impact on your body, on your health, on your brain.
How we take care of ourselves and each other. And I've only got about 30 seconds left, but research that shows that nurturing animals can actually repair some of the damage done during these early events or early infections.
Yes. So some of the most fascinating research we've done is showing that during that same critical period, very nurturing maternal care can also permanently change the phenotype of microglia within the brain. So simply having a really loving, nurturing mother can change the kind of inflammatory set point of the brain throughout the rest of the lifespan.
And of course, you use animals who have mothers who do this, but I suppose in the human population, fathers might be just as good at that kind of thing.
Yes, absolutely.
Very interesting. So going it alone could leave those microglia to end up on the kind of pathological track if you just allow a person to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. But if you build a community around them, or at least with a parent who cares, things change for them.
Yes, absolutely.
All very cool. I wish I had more time, Stacey. Pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you so much.
Stacy Bilbo, Associate Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at Duke University. That's our program for today. Thanks for listening. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio.